Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to Talking Business, a podcast produced in Melbourne, Australia. The podcast is available on the Acast site, my own website, the Apple Podcast Store, or wherever you go to get your podcasts. Or you can get it at the Business Acumen website at www.businessacumen.biz or at Banking Day. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. I am Leon Gettler. My job is to review and monitor the week's news in business, finance and economics. I bring it all to you every week. This is episode number 8 in our series for 2024, and today's date is Friday, March the 22nd. First, I'll be talking to Gartner Director of HR Advisory, Neil Woolrich, to talk about the future of work, including remote and hybrid work, employee experience and engagement. And I'll be talking to CommSec Chief Economist Craig James about what's happening in the market in the week ahead. But first, let's talk to Neil Woolrich.
Well, Neil, tell us about what's happening with hybrid work.
Well, it's a really interesting phase at the moment, Leon. We've gone through the last 2 or 3 years where hybrid work and remote work was really forced upon us because of lockdowns and the pandemic response. So a lot of organisations were forced into a situation where they had to embrace hybrid and remote work. Now, over the last sort of 6 months, 12 months or so, as the world has returned to sort of the post-pandemic new normal, if you like, employers are now in a situation where they can make a choice. You know, do we force our people to come back to the office and try and get the ways of working back to what it was before the pandemic, or do we embrace this hybrid way of working? And a lot of organizations are finding this is a really difficult choice. We've been regularly surveying organizations about, do they force people back into the office or do they keep a very hands-off approach towards hybrid work? So probably at the moment, about 1 in 3 employers are saying, we're not going to mandate for people to come back on site. We'll let employees have a say about the way they work and whether they work flexibly. But then about 1 in 3 organisations are mandating time in the office. And generally, it's around 2 days to 3 days a week in the office. And then the other 1/3 are either doing more or less than that, 2 or 3 days in the office. But what we're finding for those organisations that are mandating time in the office, employees just aren't coming in as much as they would like them to. And that's because of all sorts of sort of frictions around trying to get people work in this on-site versus hybrid model.
So some employees are resisting it?
Some employees are resisting it. And then on the other hand, we've got some leaders of organisations, mostly senior leaders, who are most vigorous about forcing people back on-site or compelling people to come back on-site. And so there's this tension between employees who want flexibility and say that they've been working productively and collaboratively in the hybrid model, versus senior leaders generally who are saying, we want people back on site because this distributed workforce is affecting our productivity and it's affecting our culture and things like that.
So what does that mean in terms of workforce management?
It's becoming a much more challenging environment. What I should say from the outset, Leon, is that hybrid work and flexible work, we've seen a raft of data, not just over the last 3 years, but even preceding COVID, a raft of data that suggested that hybrid work and flexible work models have all sorts of benefits, both in terms of business outcomes and talent outcomes. So productivity is enhanced if employees are given more flexibility, connection to culture is improved, collaboration even is improved when employees are allowed to work flexibly. But we're seeing this compulsion from senior leaders to bring people back on office because working in this hybrid manner is just a bit more difficult. What we've started to realise much more acutely recently is that every individual's needs in the hybrid environment are unique. So we can't just impose a one-size-fits-all model on everyone and hope that it works. There's a big lift, and most of that lift is on the shoulders of managers to really sort of come up with customized hybrid working models that will cater to the unique needs of all the different employees that they have across their organizations.
So customized model would mean for every employee, wouldn't it?
Pretty much so, yeah. But what we're seeing the best organizations do is provide a broad set of principles. So don't be too prescriptive. Provide a broad framework that your organization will work within, and then get managers and their team members to customize what it's going to look like in their own context. And we're seeing some really interesting solutions. You know, some of the clients that I'm talking to at the moment are doing interesting things, like if a team has parents within their team, they will come up with a team agreed charter that says, okay, we won't schedule meetings before, say, 9 a.m. and no later than, say, 3 p.m. Within that time frame, we can schedule our team meetings and be available for everyone. And then outside of that, you can make your own choices about how you're going to get your work done. So that's where that customization comes in.
Okay. What does that mean in terms of career planning?
Again, it's a bit more difficult, but you know, career planning has been one of those challenging things that was becoming more challenging even before COVID. One of the things that we talk about in career planning is destination roles for employees. Now, you know, when people of our vintage sort of entered the workforce 20, 30, 40 years ago, you could plan a destination career. You could say, okay, I come in at this entry-level role and I'll work my way up the ladder to a destination. But now these destination roles and the connecting roles in between are changing so rapidly that organizations just can't promise these destination roles anymore. So we're having to take a more agile approach. And what we're seeing the best organizations do in terms of career planning is not promise those destination roles, but give employees a more general promise that we will give you a range of experiences or a portfolio of experiences that will add to your value as employees. Now, again, that's more challenging in this distributed way of working, because employees themselves and their managers have a little bit less visibility about what's going on in the organization, because we're not as connected as we were in the pre-COVID days. So employees and their managers need to be a lot more deliberate and intentional about finding out where those opportunities are in their organizations.
What about issues like burnout and fatigue?
Oh, it's a huge issue, Leon. And it has been, you know, over the last 3 years, because of everything that everyone's gone through, burnout and fatigue has become a huge issue for a lot of organizations. So the best organizations that we're seeing are not just addressing the fatigue itself, but trying to prevent it in the first instance by reducing what we call all of the work frictions that get in the way of people being effective. So all of those barriers that organizations put in the way of people doing their jobs effectively, the best organizations are addressing them proactively to try and address that burnout and fatigue. But it's still a big issue because of everything that we're going through.
So what specifically should they be doing?
Well, it's really about assessing your organizational effectiveness as an organization. So the starting point is the work design itself, the way we design our work in our organizations. So are people clear about what their role and their goal is in terms of the work design? Do they know where to go to get information to get their job done? Do they know their important network connections to help them do their job more effectively, or so they can help others do their job more effectively? So the starting point is the work design itself. And then there are a whole lot of other frictions that we've identified as well. Some of them are things like rigid processes. You know, do we ask our people to go through multiple layers of approval before they can get a new project or a new idea started? Do we have trapped resources in our organizations, for example? If there's areas of slack in our business, can we move people from that area into an area that's overstretched at the moment? They're the kind of frictions that we need to sort of constantly analyze to make sure that we're getting ahead of these burnout issues before they become a problem.
I would imagine the hybrid model would present major challenges for any organizations going through change management.
Absolutely, yeah. Because we're working in this more distributed model, it's harder to get that information out there and harder to make sure that we know we're getting our people on board. But what we would say about change management is that the best practice that we've identified is what we call open source change management. And what I mean by that is that employees are involved in the changes as openly and as transparently and as early as possible. And I should say, Leon, we separate the change management process from the strategic decision. So the employees typically aren't involved in the strategic decision. That's something for the CEO and the board to decide. But they can be involved in the change management process by this open source approach, which we've seen the best organizations embrace. And it has its genesis in Silicon Valley and comes from the sort of open source approach to software and technology. But by involving your employees early, openly and transparently, that approach has the best chance of success of getting employees bought in and not resisting the change.
Okay, but the idea would be to bring in everyone in early.
Exactly, yeah. And then get them involved in the change process, get them involved in setting their new goals and being aligned to the reasons for the change, but also identifying resistors to the change, because we find in most organisations, probably about 40% of employees will resist the change either actively or passively. And it's those passive resistors that are really difficult to spot that we need to embrace early on in the process.
Well, from what you're saying, the hybrid work model is going to create a very different kind of organisation. And in many ways, it might be better.
Yep.
But in other ways, it's going to be certainly more challenging.
It will be. And I sort of say, Leon, at the moment, we're going through this trough of disillusionment around hybrid work, that people are realising the difficult work that we need to do to make hybrid happen effectively. Now, some organisations have done this pretty well, but others are just realising that we need to sort of stay the course on this, because as I said before, there are all sorts of benefits in terms of business outcomes and employee outcomes that suggest to us that hybrid work is here to stay. We're not going back to sort of the pre-COVID days, and employees are telling us loud and clear that they want that flexibility, and if they don't get it, they will vote with their feet.
Well, Neil, it's been fascinating talking to you and wishing you and Gartner all the best. Thank you.
Thank you, Liam. Great to talk to you too.
And now let's talk to CommSec Chief Economist, Craig James.
Well, Craig, what do you see for the market for the week ahead?
Well, certainly I think the major focus has got to be in terms of inflation. Inflation is very much the focus right the way across the globe. The hope is that we can get the inflation rates down. That means interest rates come down. That means economies grow at a faster pace. So The key will be this week in Australia, the monthly consumer price indicator. Now, it's not comprehensive. It doesn't cover services to the extent that we'd probably like. But it's running at a 3.4% annual pace. If you look at the underlying measure, the trim mean, it's 3.8%. So still a long way from where the Reserve Bank wants to, somewhere between 2 and 3%. What we need to see is if you've got a lift in prices for the month of 0.2%, that means we'd see stabilization of the that core consumer price indicator at a 3.4% annual rate. Anything below 0.2% lift would be positively viewed. So certainly in Australia, that'll be the focus, I think, over the week. It comes out on Wednesday, that monthly consumer price indicator. And then on Thursday, just before we go into the Easter break, we've got retail trade figures, and a lot of interest in terms of Taylor Swift and what the impact she's had in terms of overall spending there. But it's been fairly volatile retail trade over the last couple of months. We saw an increase of 2.2% in November, a fall of 0.8% in December, and then in January, a 1.1% rise. So certainly the post-Christmas sales are still the key event on the retail calendar. Certainly the Black Friday, Cyber Monday sort of sales in November. If we look at the United States, there's a fair few indicators coming out, as is always the case with the United States. Things like home prices, home sales, a measure of consumer confidence is coming out. We have to wait until Good Friday. We have to wait until the personal income and spending figures come out for really the biggie of the week. And that's the main measure of inflation in the United States, the core personal consumption expenditure deflator. And that's the Federal Reserve's preferred measure of inflation. As I say, it doesn't come out until Good Friday. And on Good Friday, what we have is the U.S. markets are closed for U.S. share market is closed, but we've still got that data sort of coming out. So we won't see the reaction until probably the following week. But what we've got in the United States is a fairly useful reading. The annual rate of the personal consumption expenditure deflator, the PCE deflator, 2.4%. The annual rate, the core rate is 2.8%. So they're getting much closer to where the Federal Reserve would like interest rates, around about 2%.
But the last figures show US CPI was increasing more than expected.
Yeah, and that's the major concern. Yes, sort of we've had some readings of consumer prices, producer prices, even export-import prices, which suggests that inflation is not dead and buried. Yes, sort of the dragon, yes, sort of has only been sleeping, yes, sort of modestly, and yes, sort of now it's perhaps getting roused again. So that's the concern, yes, sort of, and that's why we're going to be closely looking at these measures. I suppose the other thing to highlight is on Thursday, we've got the economic growth figures, and the US economy is running at something like a 3.2% annual pace. So still fairly good growth happening in the United States. No fears of recession. But the US Federal Reserve has seemingly done in terms of interest rate hikes. Hope is that, you know, you can stay on the sidelines, and the next move in interest rates will be around about, you know, sort of June, perhaps, you know, sort of a little bit later than that in terms of an interest rate cut.
So the US Federal Reserve is not talking about hikes, they're talking more about hold or cut. Is that right?
Yeah, certainly that's the language that's come out. And yes, the recent testimony from the Federal Reserve chair is seemingly saying the same sort of thing, that now we're wanting to see the full evidence of inflation coming down. I suppose, you know, sort of if we continue to see disappointments, though, the Fed will probably, you know, sort of come out and say, well, we're looking at the situation a little bit more closely. And that would be a real shock to share markets if it came to a more neutral stance, meaning that they could go either way in terms of interest rates rather than the modest easing tilt that they have in terms of current policy settings.
Yes, and I mean, one of the problems with inflation, as Michelle Bullock said, one of the problems with inflation in Australia is it's got a four in front of it, and it has to, which would mean it'd have to come down to at least to the low threes till we see a rate cut.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve and all central banks basically are saying the same thing, that they want to have confidence that inflation is on the way down. It doesn't have to meet the goal of being, to say, 2% in the United States or 2.5% in Australia. It doesn't have to meet that goal, but they have to have significant confidence that inflation is on its way down, and it will go towards, certainly achieve those inflation targets down the track. So once it is much more confident in terms of the situation, then we'll start to see, you know, the Fed more confident in terms of cutting interest rates and providing a bit more stimulus to the economy.
And the inflation figures in Australia don't have anything about services, which would be a major concern for the Reserve Bank here.
Yeah, I mean, you're not getting that reading on services in this figure coming out yesterday on Wednesday, but we'll be looking very closely at other aspects of it and seeing sort of what flow through the goods prices may have in terms of services. But yeah, all the indicators that we are getting is the economy has slowed quite remarkably, particularly in terms of the consumer spending sort of parts of the economy. And if they continue to slow, that means business is going to be much more reluctant in terms of lifting prices. And if that's the case, then we will indeed, you know, sort of creep our way towards the Reserve Bank's target.
Which indeed would suggest that the Reserve Bank's policy of lifting interest rates has been doing its job.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, you know, sort of all the anecdotes that we are seeing, you know, sort of is that there's tougher times out there for consumer-faced businesses. We're certainly not seeing consumer spending, yes, going gangbusters. We're seeing, yes, sort of much more restraint and much more choice by consumers about where they want.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Where they want to spend their money.
Right, and in terms of the retail figures, I mean, they're fairly volatile.
Yeah, no, they have been volatile, and unfortunately, yes, we've got a new seasonal effect in there where November has become much more significant month in terms of the Christmas-January period. So, but what we do need to do is basically average it out. And if you do average it out, we've got growth happening in terms of retail spending, but fairly modest, and that's a good indicator for the Reserve Bank. It means that people are becoming much more circumspect about particularly discretionary or non-essential spending.
So what effect would you say Taylor Swift's had on retail spending?
It could see a pickup in terms of spending in terms of, say, cafes and restaurants and the like. In terms of merchandise gear, might fall into the clothing category. But you may see a cutback in other areas. And that's why we're interested in seeing it, to see what sort of effect it's had on pushing forward spending in some ways and pushing back spending in other ways.
Okay, so you would expect them to still remain fairly volatile in that case?
Yeah, no, certainly, yes, that will be the case, I think, in terms of retail trade. I suppose the other key interest point is that the coming week is a big week for delivery of dividend payments to investors. Dividends worth upwards of $35 billion are expected over this period of time where dividend payments are released. And coming up in the coming week, on Wednesday, something in the order of $7 billion will be paid out in terms of dividend payments. So that's quite significant. Then you go to Thursday and something like $11.5 billion is going to be paid out. Well, people will decide what to do with their dividends that they do receive. And some of those might say, look, times are tough at the moment. I'm going to hold on to these dividends. I'm going to pay a few bills. And that means I haven't got to use my spending in other ways to be able to meet my commitments. So, these dividend payments are certainly worth watching over the coming week.
Right, okay. And so it would indicate that the market's still doing quite well.
Well, yes. I mean, companies are still keen to pay out dividends. Profits are being challenged, but companies need to get the capital injection coming through. Of course, when you've got profit, companies can decide to pay them out in terms of dividends. They could pay more people to come on their payrolls and pay them more money. And they could also put it back into the firm in terms of buying new equipment and the like. Some others may be preparing for takeover type activity or merger type activity. So certainly, the companies have got a degree of choice, but they still like to pay it out in terms of dividends so they can see their shareholders happy and staying with their investment in the company.
Well, Craig, thank you very much again.
Not a problem at all.
So what's happening in the news? Well, the Reserve Bank has left interest rates on hold amid signs that growth in the economy has dramatically slowed down following 13 interest rate rises since May 2022. The decision to keep rates on hold was widely anticipated, with few economists expecting another rate hike. However, many are predicting the RBA will start cutting interest rates in the second half of this year as inflation continues to moderate. The cash rate remains at 4.35%. Inflation will keep falling from here, but the pace of the improvement will slow. Recent bumps in US inflation highlight the challenges faced in returning inflation to target. On top of that, Aussie services inflation will need more coaxing to come down, and the looming stage 3 tax cuts will add demand to the economy at the same time the RBA is trying to take it out. While there's no certainty about when interest rates may fall, there are fears the impact of previous rate cuts may slow down the economy more than anticipated. The Reserve Bank, the federal government and Treasury have spent much of the past two years focused on fighting inflation. The challenge now is to ensure that growth doesn't slow down so forcefully that it tips Australia into a recession. The RBA said the board is not ruling anything in or out as far as rates go. As supply of new homes will crash to the lowest level in over a decade by 2026, worsening housing and rental affordability
and leaving the federal government far short of its goal to build 1.2 million homes by mid-2029. Across capital cities, 79,000 new homes will be finished in 2026, a drop of 26% compared with last year due to planning bottlenecks, labour shortages and soaring material costs. The slump, predicted by industry lobby group the Urban Development Institute of Australia in a new report, will ratchet up house prices and rents, both of which are already record high. Based on its forecast, the industry will need to double its capacity and build an eye-watering 300,000 homes between 2026 and 2029 to meet the 1.2 million target. Aranjoey Chief Economist Joe Masters said the 1.2 million target was aspirational. "We've never been able to build that many homes," Ms. Masters said. Federal Housing Minister Julie Collins said the government was working with states and territories to help meet the ambitious national target of building 1.2 million homes by July 2029. She cited a $3 billion new homes bonus, $500 million housing support programs, $10 billion Housing Australia Future Fund, and new incentives to boost the supply of rental housing. The new homes bonus is a $15,000 payment that states and territories will receive for every home delivered above the old target of 1 million homes in the hopes of reaching 1.2 million. Building companies have told me the biggest problems they are holding up work is a shortage of skilled trades. They say the most severe shortages are in the finishing trades, such as tilers, painters and carpenters. That's why leading developers like Lendlease have called for the fast-tracking of visas for migrant construction workers and greater investment in infrastructure delivery to boost the supply of new homes and address the deepening housing crisis. And minor parties led by the Greens will push for the Australian Competition Consumer Commission to get new powers to break up companies that misuse market powers to inflate prices. The changes proposed by the Greens, and which could find support from the Nationals and some crossbench senators, would allow the competition watchdog to apply to the federal court to force the divestiture of companies found to have misused their market power. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese last month rubbished calls for divestiture powers, saying, "We're not the old Soviet Union." Australia's two major supermarket chains have come under intense political scrutiny over claims of price gouging, profiteering, its treatment of suppliers and making large profits during the cost of living crisis. The Australian Retail Association rejected claims Coles and Woolworths had failed to pass on lower costs to consumers through lower prices, resulting in an unacceptable level of profitability. It told senators net profits after tax had increased at a much slower rate than either sales or costs. It said the supermarket sector was not becoming less competitive, pointing to new entrants in the market, including Aldi and Australian Bureau of Statistics data, showing food retailing operating margins have reduced from 7.2% in 2008 to 4.8% in 2022. And the competition watchdog has asked major media groups to rate their deals with Meta and reveal how much money they make from Facebook and Instagram as it prepares to decide whether the tech giant should be forced into the negotiating table. In confidential documents sent to news outlets, the Australian Competition Consumer Commission demanded extensive details about how media outlets make money, how important social media is, and what would happen if Meta blocked all news. One publisher said a news ban would cut its revenue by 25%. Meta, then known as Facebook, agreed to pay at least $70 million to outlets in 13 deals struck under the News Media Bargaining Code, a law introduced in 2021 by the Coalition to correct the power imbalance between news outlets and Facebook and Google. Earlier this month, Meta announced it would not renew those three-year deals, which end late this year. News is not a vital part of its platform, it said, claiming to send 2.3 billion referrals to Australian publishers last year, worth $115 million. The ACCC is advising Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones whether to force Meta to negotiate deals with news outlets known as designation. "It is a politically loaded question that will have a significant effect on Australia's media landscape. Media outlets have suffered a deep downturn in advertising over the past year, cutting hundreds of jobs as people and companies tighten their belts in a cost-of-living crisis. An increasingly fragmented advertising market, dominated by Google and Meta, but with powerful emerging players in Amazon and TikTok, is making it harder for media outlets to make money to pay for news." The ACCC has asked each publisher for a ranking of what drives revenue: subscriptions, advertising or physical sales, for example, and how much money publishers make in total and from Facebook and Instagram referrals. Private health insurer Bupa has joined the growing ranks of white-collar employers experimenting with shorter work weeks after launching a 9-day fortnight trial late last year. The pilot gives participating employees an extra day off each fortnight without reducing their pay, and comes after rival health insurer Medibank started testing a 4-day week in October. Staff involved in the trial are guaranteed an extra day off each fortnight and are not expected to work the same number of hours in 9 days as they did in 10. Participating employees also take different days off to ensure there are no disruptions to the health insurance service delivery. Cecilia Herbert, Principal Behavioural Scientist at employee experience platform Qualtrics, said 4 day weeks and 9 day fortnights could potentially deliver huge value to organisations adopting them. Hundreds of employees are believed to be taking a part. When Medibank launched its 4 day week trial, Group Lead for People, Spaces and Sustainability, Kylie Bishop, said it was about empowering employees to cut out low value tasks and focus on doing work that had the greatest impact for customers. Medibank's trial was based on the 180-100 model advocated by global advocacy group 4 day Week Global. Employees retain 100% of their pay but reduce their working hours to 80% while seeking to maintain 100% of their productivity. And Commonwealth Bank is expanding its lending market by switching the focus of its behavioural economics team to climate change. The savings on the average electricity bill from installing rooftop solar, batteries and heat pumps are now so attractive that it is economically irrational not to go for it, especially when financed with discounting lending rates. There are potentially billions of dollars of loans to be made to customers electrifying their homes by switching from coal-fired power and gas appliances to solar and battery-powered. An equally large line of lending opportunities will be available from the switch to electric vehicles and home-connected EV chargers. CBA comes to household electrification with advantages. Let's face it, CBA is the main financial institution for 35% of Australians. It has a quarter of all mortgages sold in Australia, and it has a suite of products for financing rooftop solar panels, batteries, heat pumps and Teslas, which account for more than half the EVs sold in Australia. Scientist Saul Griffith told CBA's third annual sustainability conference in Sydney last week that about $2 trillion could be spent electrifying residential houses between now and 2050. If that happens, he said, there'll be $1.7 trillion in fossil fuel savings. And CBA aims to be providing most of those loans. And lawyers behind a class action lawsuit run on behalf of Australian taxi drivers against Uber Technologies say the US company has agreed to pay $272 million in the fifth largest class action settlement in Australian legal history. In an announcement on Sunday night, Maurice Blackburn lawyers said the Supreme Court of Victoria would sit on Monday morning to close out a case that began in 2019. The lawsuit was initially brought on behalf of Melbourne taxi driver Nikos Andrianakis, but grew as a class action to incorporate more than 8,000 taxi and charter drivers who said Uber had harmed them financially by setting up and running its UberX services in Australia illegally. The case was due to run on May 17, but a deal has been struck. It was fully announced on Monday morning. In a statement on Sunday night, Maurice Blackburn lawyers principal Michael Donnelly said the historic settlement followed a gruelling 5-year legal battle. He said Uber had fought tooth and nail at every point along the way, but had finally blinked. The case against Uber, which first launched in Sydney in 2012, was for lost income for drivers and loss in the value of licences purchased by taxi and hire car, limousine and charter vehicle owners, when Uber launched with cheaper and more convenient services despite being unlicensed. And Canadian private equity giant Brookfield has been in talks with Singaporean company Singtel to buy close to 20% of Optus. Should the company be worth about $16 billion, that would put the size of the deal at around $3 billion. Talk about a sale have been unfolding for at least a couple of months and were flagged in an industry publication around the end of last year. If it goes ahead, it will be the biggest foreign investor to foreign investor sale in Australian history. And Corporate Australia, reciting Australia's skill shortage, as a chunk of large businesses look to slash learning and development budgets this year to combat a deterioration in the economy. 1 in 8 medium and large Australian businesses are planning to slash their learning and development budgets by 50% this year, with Deloitte Access Economics and RMIT Online estimating it will result in missing out on skills valued at $2 billion or $5.6 million per day. This comes as a skills gap has been further exacerbated by the emergence of critical technologies such as AI. Analysis shows 1.8 million new tech skills will be needed by 2030 if workers are to keep pace with changes. Industries with lower employment growth were more likely to cut learning budgets, including consumer services businesses and construction, which has seen a number of outfits go insolvent in the past year because of inflationary pressures. Deloitte Access Economics partner John Omani warned a substantial chunk of businesses slashing training budgets was a key indicator businesses would be looking to make redundancies amid a slowdown in the country's economy. And Rio Tinto has bowed to a sustained pressure from big investors to start reporting how much it spends on the so-called green steel projects and other efforts to reduce carbon emissions for iron ore mined in Australia and turned into steel in China. The decision improves so-called Scope 3 disclosures and comes after what Fidelity International and the Australian Council of Superannuation Investors described as years lobbying for better financial transparency. Fidelity and ACSI are charged with representing the priorities of Climate Action 100, a group of institutional investors responsible for about US 68 trillion, that's 104 trillion Aussie, in assets under management in discussions with Rio. Rio said on Tuesday that it agreed to beef up its reporting on efforts to reduce carbon emissions from the processing of iron ore by its mainly Chinese steelmaking customers. The company intends to spend up to US $6 billion on decarbonisation across its business to 2030. Rio committed to improving disclosure on investments to reduce customer or Scope 3 emissions from processing iron ore through investment in green steelmaking projects and other technologies. It will now reveal how much it spent on steel decarbonisation and provide spending forecasts over three-year periods, along with detailing what milestones have been achieved. And MYOB and Xero face competition for their accounting tools from National Australia Bank, which is using artificial intelligence to create a rival focused on sole traders. NAB Bookmaker is an entry for the bank into the small business software market dominated by the cloud accounting giants. The software uses machine learning to help small traders automate administrative tasks such as invoicing and managing cash flow. NAB, the country's largest business bank by loans, will undercut Xero's and MYOB's pricing. And while their payments are typically overseen by human accountants, the banks will be fully automated. The process was developed by Thryday, a startup that the bank's venture capital fund invested in 2 years ago. Thryday was founded by former ANZ head of mobile banking, Michael Nusiforo. Mr. Nusiforo, citing Reserve Bank data, said about 60% of Australia's 2 million businesses use cloud accounting software, mostly Xero or MYOB. This left a big target market for bookkeeper, especially among the tradespeople, creatives, gig workers and consultants. And that's it for this week. And next week I'll be talking to Endeavour Environmental founder Matt Drum and his views on climate change and the impact this will have on the private sector. And I'll be talking to economist Nicholas Gruen about how Australia Post can improve its services in the bush by letting in some competition. For the most exclusive access to leading economists and business leaders from around the world, subscribe to Talking Business from my website, leongettler.com. If you like Talking Business, please leave us a review with Apple Podcasts. Thank you in advance. In the meantime, you catch me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn and YouTube. And if you want, leave a comment. If you want to contact me, email me at leon@leongettler.com. I answer all emails. Wishing you all a safe and healthy week and looking forward to bringing you Talking Business next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.